This is Julie at Dogcast Radio. If you like dogs, wherever you are in the world, we're the show for you. Hello and welcome to episode 17 of Dogcast Radio, and this time we have a Scottish flavour. We visit the Highland Wildlife Park to find out about the ancestor of our modern dog, the wolf.
In wolf hierarchy and etiquette, a black wolf cub gets away with boob murder. I mean, when they're walking around and they're babies, they can come up to the dominant male and take food from his mouth and he'll say, that's fine.
In the news, we hear about the perils that can befall dogs in Scotland.
For the second time this year, an eagle owl has been on the loose. Apparently, these large birds, who in the wild prey on other birds, small mammals, and even foxes and young deer, are strong enough to lift cats and dogs.
And Buddy tells his side of things.
I've been deserted by my family.
We had a wonderful time up in Scotland, and our first visit was heaven for dog lovers.
Hello, we're in Scotland, in the beautiful Cairngorms. And although it's late April, there's still snow on the mountains. We've come to the UK's only dog sled centre. But the dogs here don't always run on snow, and they're not all huskies. I'm talking now with John Stewart at the Cairngorms Sled Dog Centre. And first of all, can you tell us what activities you have on offer here?
Well, the Sled Dog Centre firstly is open all year round for tours. And that's where people can come up, have a look around the kennel. We show them around, sort of a guided sort of tour around the kennel. Got shown all the dogs, explained a brief history and what we do and that, what we've done. And that pretty much lasts about an hour and a half and that, and they're here. And it's a small sort of fee for that. But the trips out with the dogs are sort of confined to the colder parts of the years. They usually start in about September and usually end about this time. And then we do courses as well. Courses are 2 days long, and there's just lots to do sort of thing. Mm-hmm.
So do you take the rides out? Are they on snow or are they not on snow?
No, we've got a buggy that has 4 wheels and 2 seats. And it was brought over from Germany, and it's a very good bit of kit. And it's lasted 3 years now of bombardment on these trails, and which is good. But my dad's got a new one coming over from Canada, and it should be the one to replace it.
Right.
It's got bigger suspension, and it should last a lot longer.
Mm. All right. And going on to the dogs, how do you train them to pull the buggy?
The dogs naturally like to pull. Some people find that very amazing, but if they came here and saw puppies growing up, they would just think, wow, these dogs just love doing what they do. And that's pretty much it.
Mm.
I mean, if you go into a lot of breeding programs and start breeding dogs very specifically, you'll get dogs that are just naturally just take to the harness and just start running right away.
Mm.
It's just unbelievable. It's wonderful to watch. The last lot of pups that we had... There was one dog called Blondie, and she just took to the harness right away, and it was unbelievable what we could see. It was the best dog we'd ever seen. It's just setting up to be probably one of the best dogs we've ever had as well.
Mm-hmm. And what age do they have to be before they start pulling?
Usually we collar and harness break them about 5 to 6 months old. And then any time after that, when we think ready, we can sort of put them on a line and that and get them running. Sometimes it takes longer for some, sometimes shorter for others. Mm. So it's just a long process of puppy training.
Mm. And is there a limit to sort of when they can take a good amount of weight? Do you have to watch with the skeletal development?
Yes, especially at that age. Usually we train the pups, sort of one pup, one adult beside them, so they can learn with an older dog. So usually it's about a 10-dog team, depending on how many puppies we are. Usually an 8-dog team, 4 dogs, and then we run twice over if we've got 8 pups.
Mm.
And, yeah. But we train with ATVs, quads. So the pulling is pretty much confined because we use the engine.
Mm.
So they're sort of running, and we're keeping up with them in the quad, so they don't feel so much pull at that young age.
Yeah, yeah. So it's for the experience of getting used to it.
It's just the experience. It's them, because they'll be like, oh, what's this neckline hooked on here? And what's this thing around me? And what's this thing hooked on at the back? And that. It's just to get them used to that. And sometimes we run really slow, and myself and my mum, my dad will be driving it. Myself and my mum will be out in the team walking with them, just like encouraging them and that. Mm.
So it's a very gradual...
It's a very gradual process, but we like it when dogs just click right away and just go straight into it, which is brilliant, because it saves a lot of work. But usually, if you get a few like that, you are left with some, and they take a lot of work.
Alright. And you haven't just got Siberian Huskies here, have you? You've got the pointers and the pointer crosses as well. How did that come about?
Pointers originally were used in the Scandinavian areas. They were used to pull small sleds and that. And what happened was hunters would go out with them on the sled and they would hunt, and then it would be used to pull back, like, the catch of the day, sort of a deer or whatever, on this sled. So then they thought up the idea of putting them in dog sleds as well. And it worked out pretty well. I mean, in Alaska they started using them before anywhere else, pretty much, in proper teams. And now the pointers and any sort of hound mix are being put into teams because they're more powerful, they've got more endurance. Pretty much the overall quality of the dog is better, more suited for faster speeds and just faster racing all round. That's why they were used.
Alright. And does it help them cope with sort of the weather, you know, the summer weather at all, or is that...?
Not really, no. The all-round sort of wanting to go sort of still there, and the dogs overheat quickly. Doesn't really matter what the sort of coat is, they still overheat quite badly. I mean, the pointers that we've got out, the full sort of pointers, they struggle just as much as any of the other dogs out there. Anything over like 10 degrees Celsius and it's all off. Sometimes we've had to cancel people that have come up. We're like, sorry, we can't take dogs out because it's over 10 degrees. It's just, it's better for the dogs, pretty much. I mean, the dogs might be able to do it, but it's just the thoughts there of the dogs collapsing on us. It's just heat exhaustion, isn't it, pretty much?
If there's any danger to them, it's not worth doing it.
It's not worth it, no.
No. And so they, obviously, we've said, you know, they like pulling, they just take to it. It's something they enjoy.
They love it.
And what about, you know, the kennel tours? What do they like the attention they get there?
They love the attention. Especially the dogs in the first kennel, where they come into, the dogs love them. Especially there's a black dog as they come in, and he loves to jump up on you. We try to get people in. What happens is my mum holds the dog, and the people walk in to get past them first, because he's just so excited. But all the dogs, they love getting stroked and that. And some of them are a bit wary of people, but none of them are aggressive to people, though. They're just a bit, some of them are a bit timid.
Yeah. So, is there any chance we can go and meet some of the dogs?
Sure, it's fine.
Okay, great.
So, we went to meet the dogs, who gave us a rousing welcome, as you can hear. On the Dog Sled website, we'd seen photos of JR, a very cheeky dog who pokes his head through the gate, and I was eager to meet him.
Where's JR? We looked at the website. And
JR, gorgeous. JR's over here. Yeah.
And these are husky pointer crosses.
These are their English pointer mother with an Alaskan husky father. So the majority of the breed is pointer.
Yeah.
So hence why they look floppy ears.
Yeah.
Short coat.
Oh, beautiful. There's a gorgeous photograph of JR on the website, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. Yeah, that picture I put in a competition here and it won. So what happened was a new pet shop opening, and I got a big, huge photograph taken, a professional photograph taken, and now it's sitting inside the house, but there's a big one sitting in the new pet shop. So he's pretty famous around here. A lot of people know him.
You're beautiful. Gosh, he's got the husky eyes.
That's about the only thing you can see. You just think, oh, that's a husky. That. Huskies have the blue eyes, and then he's got blue eyes, and you think, oh, yeah.
There's a quite a variety in the appearances, isn't there, with the mixes?
The two here, these are my dad's lead dogs. And the black one is Buster. He's a purebred German Shorty pointer. He was, last year he was voted Britain's greatest dog. And there's a lot of background to that, like. But it was my dad that set him up. Them two are sort of the main sort of characters here. There's Chacal here. He's an Alaskan Husky, and he's what you would commonly think he's an Alaskan Husky. Looking at him, he's got a sore ear at the minute. He's in his ear.
Aww, and
he was in a bit of a fight. And
Is there much? Do they sort of generally get on? Or
they do generally get on, yeah. Usually, if there's any fighting to be done, it's over food. But most of the time it doesn't happen.
Yeah. And when you say they're like lead dogs, does that sort of put them in an alpha position? Or
They're known around the kennel as sort of being the lead dogs. I mean, they always run up front. Buster not so much nowadays because he's in the stage of retirement. Buster! Shh! He's being noisy now. He's the dad of the pups around there as well. So, all the dogs sort of know that they're the lead dogs. They run up front and that. So.
And do you sort of look for the dominant personality and then you reinforce that? Or is it just the running skills? What is it that...
It's just having brains, I think, at the end of the day. Mm. The dog that have the brains, they listen to you. And if they listen to you, they'll take the turns. That's why the lead dogs go up front and they take the turns. So that's pretty much what they're up there for. Yeah. They're just taking the turns.
And how many dogs do you have here?
32. There's 32 dogs here at the minute. More on the way. Puppies on the way.
Oh, so. Wow.
Do you ever do any sledging on the snow, or is it always
on the cart? I do. I was over in Alaska 2 years ago. I was training and racing with a world champion out there. Mm. And that was a dream come true, pretty much, when I heard that I was going to be able to go out there and help him. Mm. I was pretty much his handler for 6 months. And that was a dream come true for me. And I went out there and I just loved it right from the word go. Mm. It was unbelievable. And snow all the time. Just snow. And I was running big teams. Compared to here, the biggest team I've ever ran is four dogs and a buggy. Mm. The biggest team I ran out there was 20 dogs on a sled. Mm. And it was just unbelievable.
Yeah.
It was the best thing I've ever done.
But, and is the feeling of sort of doing the sledding on snow, is it similar? Or what are the differences between doing it on snow and not?
I think at the end of the day, the snow is what you immediately think snow, and that's what you run the dogs on, snow. But on the buggies, it's different because you're on three wheels racing. Racing buggies have got three wheels. So there's a lot of instability and all that stuff. You can flip over. But saying that, people flip over on sleds as well, but I find sleds a whole much better. Mm. Far more in control. I mean, you can't even really stop on a rig because there's only brakes and that. There's no handbrake or anything. And the thing's so light, the dogs would just go, take off and leave it. But on a sled, I mean, you've got snow hooks, you stop them, you put the snow hook in, and it's sort of pretty grounded there for a while anyway, until the dogs build up enough momentum and they take off again.
Mm. Yeah. And how long have you been sledding?
Since I was 6 years old.
Mm. Yeah.
So it's 14 years now, it's a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
But, I'll tell you, I've got a story for you now. I'm just thinking.
Okay.
It was when I was in Alaska. It's not the dogs here, but just to show you what can happen. I was on the second day of an event, and I was lying third. And just coming up to, I was about 3-4 miles from the finish line. And there was a sort of a checkpoint there, and what happens is the timings get put back to show how far are you ahead. And I had friends out there, and they said that I was catching up in second place. So if I'd finished in the time I was doing it, I would have come second behind the world champion. He was first. And I was coming around this really quite narrow section. Buster! I was coming around this narrow section, and all of a sudden I see this cameraman in the distance. And he's walking on the trail. And I shout, "Get off the trail!" And he looks around and sees me. So he runs, and then he jumps off the trail. But then he comes back and gets really close. And gets down low, and immediately I just thought, oh no, these dogs are going to spook at this. And sure enough, lead dogs, like that. The dogs behind them, the point dogs, run over the top of the lead dogs, and oh, it's just a mess. And needless to say, I was shouting some rather unfriendly words at that photographer, but he refused to help me as well. He ran off, so I thought I was pretty bad that.
Yeah.
So, but I still managed to finish third.
Oh,
I got the dogs stopped and put the snow hook in and got them all tangled out. But as soon as I got them fixed, they pulled the snow hook and the team took off.
Mm.
But I managed to jump on the sled as it came past. So that's the
wow.
That was the exciting thing on my whole trip there.
And when they have like a big pile up or you know like that, presumably they sort of get straight back up and go. They don't get spooked by it, or do they?
Sometimes they do. Yes. Depends. Depends what the dog's like. If the dog's pretty solid headed, then the dog will be all right. The dog will be like, "What's a tango?" And then once they're all right again, they'll be like, "Okay, that's fine. Let's go again now." But the dogs I was racing out there are world class, you know. So they were fine. So depends what your dogs are like, I suppose. It depends how well you deal with the situation too. If you know what you're doing, then the dogs will see you know what you're doing as well.
Okay, thank you very much for your time.
That's all right, thanks.
The Dog Sled Centre is an excellent place with great dogs. They're lovely. Do visit if you're ever near Aviemore. The sledding is great fun, but if you are into dogs, the kennel tour is a must. There's a link on our website to the Dog Sled Centre website. Buddy's Diary.
Hello, Buddy the Black Labrador here. I've been deserted by my family. Don't worry though, because although my alpha family have gone off on something called a holiday, I'm very lucky in that I have a beta family, and they've moved in with me to see to my needs. Being a dog, I do value routine, but I've mentioned before that I don't object too much to a disruption to my routine, as long as there is some benefit in it for me. My beta family is Grandma and Grandpa. They are older than my alpha family, and things are quite different when they are around. The first time they moved in to look after me, I wasn't sure I was happy with the arrangement, but I soon learned I could work it to my advantage. On the day my alpha family leave, I play along and pretend that I am desperately sorry that they're going away. I do the whole bit, big sad eyes, droopy body language, moping on my bed. Usually I get not only lots of fuss, but lots of treats too. It must be awful for my alpha people to know they'll not see me for several days, so I give them lots of attention and stand on the doorstep with my grandma and grandpa waving them off. I do not let my tail wag until my family is out of sight, but then I bound inside for the fun and games to start. Usually the first thing that happens is that I get a lovely bone or some other long-lasting goodie that I retire to my bed with. I think the idea is that this will take my mind off being abandoned, and without wanting to sound shallow, it works. Pretty soon I've worked my way through the bone and I'm ready for some exercise. This is a major bonus of my beta family. They don't do that pesky working, so they have lots of spare time to spend with me, so we get lots of leisurely walks when I get some quality sniffing done. A strange quirk of Grandma and Grandpa is that they always wear things called slippers. I wasn't initially in favour of slippers, as they protect the feet and toes from any licking I might want to do. But you can play a wonderful game with them. What happens is this. Grandma or Grandpa will ease off their slippers to put their feet up on the sofa. They leave their slippers on the floor and pretend to be reading a newspaper or watching television. This is the signal to me that the game has begun. I inch towards the slippers, usually on my belly, and I go slowly so as not to attract attention. Once I have the slipper in my mouth, stealth is no longer necessary, and I bound gleefully off to the garden with my prize securely in my mouth. They may be older, but they throw themselves into the game, hopping eagerly after me in their one remaining slipper, waving their arms and shouting at me to encourage me in my efforts to evade them. This game can go on as long as we like, and usually ends with me exchanging the slipper for a biscuit. The really good thing about this game is that we can play it again and again and again. It's a game I used to play with my Alpha family when I was young, but after a few times, they just ignored me, and even shut me out with whatever I had managed to acquire, so the game was spoiled. But Grandma and Grandpa have mastered it very well, even varying it from time to time by leaving a handkerchief where I can get hold of it. But that version is not so much fun for them as they walk or run without the added enjoyment of hopping. A game I have long been the loser in with my Alpha family is See Who Can Take Up the Most Room on the Sofa. If it looks like I'm getting anywhere near winning, they make me jump down, re-establish a position of strength, and then allow me back up to take a disgustingly small fragment of the sofa. If I pursue the game too vigorously, they even resort to all-out cheating, when I'm instructed to get down onto the floor and not allowed back up for a long time. However, Grandma and Grandpa are good sports and will play this game for hours. One of them will be sitting on the sofa. I will jump up and join them and cuddle up against them. If I do a good flop down while leaning against them, I can gain several inches, and by maintaining the momentum while pretending to sleep, I can get control of about 9/10 of the sofa. I am the sofa king. A nice thing is that although they always lose, they keep playing. Morning routines are different with my backup family too. My Alpha pack ignored my desperate whines and howls in the early morning, so I've learned to save my energy. And curl up patiently on my bed until that lazy lot get out of bed. However, Grandma and Grandpa are up and at 'em as soon as I emit a few whines. They seem to mistake my pleas for company for a need for a toilet break, as they hurriedly let me out into the garden. I happily oblige and then trot back in for companionship and hopefully breakfast. That's another great thing. My main family have learned that I am always hungry and will eat whatever is put in front of me and check with one another as to whether anyone has fed me. Grandma and Grandpa, however, are much cleverer than that, and I have managed to train them that when I whine sadly and sit in front of my food dish, I am desperately close to starvation and they feed me. Just call me Two Breakfasts Buddy. I think you can see that even though my Alpha family have deserted me, I am still well tended for by sympathetic, innovative carers. Apparently some dogs pine for their owners when left behind, but I'm a positive fellow and seek out the good in any situation. What really bothers me is how Grandma and Grandpa cope with their lonely, empty existence when my family come back and oust them. I can only suppose they are sustained by the knowledge that there will be other holidays or even the odd weekend where we'll be reunited. I can't understand why they don't get a dog of their own. After all the joy of dog ownership I've shown them, how can they resist? The early mornings, daily exercise regime, always having me to care for and consider, the evenings spent squashed in a tiny fraction of the sofa wearing soggy slippers. Who wouldn't love that? Humans are just strange. Well, till next time.
Wolves are the ancestors of our modern dog breeds, and they once lived and roamed free in Scotland. They're back there now, in the Highland Wildlife Park. Watching the wolf pack as they interacted, I was struck by how much was familiar from dog behaviour, and we can gain invaluable insights into our dogs by finding out more about wolves. We spoke to park manager Jeremy Usher-Smith.
Can you tell us about the wolves that you actually have here?
We have a group of European wolves here who are, basically made up of a dominant female and five males. There's a dominant male who is, if you see them walking around together, there's usually the male and the female are close together and the other ones are not so close. But at times we've observed them for periods during the 24 hours. We have people watching them. You get a situation where the group will actually sleep together. They all come down and curl up close together, so that it's a definite group. The males are all related. They're half brothers and brothers, so they come from one pack, and the females come from another pack.
Mm.
So they're actually from it's a completely new group.
And did you introduce them here?
Yes.
And what's that process like?
It's with all canids, the big problem is that maybe they don't get on with each other. I mean, it's all very well to, everyone says, oh, you just have a male and a female together, they all get on together, and you get a process where they have to mix, and the female actually has got to have the territory first, had control of the area, so the males come in and have her smell all over everything. Naturally, in the wild, a wolf pack feeds together. This gives the whole group a chance to actually get close together, but also in a way to start testing the pecking order. I mean, the youngsters often get away with the youngest ones here are just a year old, and you can still see there's a sort of blush of dark in their fur. When they're newborn, they're almost all black. And in wolf hierarchy and etiquette, a black wolf cub gets away with food murder. I mean, when they're walking around and they're babies, they can come up to the dominant male and take food from his mouth, and he'll say, that's fine, you're just a little infant. But as they get older, the coat gets lighter. So by the first winter, their winter coat's coming through, but there's still a sort of, the tips of the black hair is still showing through, so they're still considered with slightly the lower status, and being low status, they are also allowed to get away with a bit more than, I mean, the second ranking male, the beta male, is pushed around far more.
Is that because he's got a better shot at actually taking over?
Yes, that's part of it, but it's also that he's that step down. There is a strange system of biology within the wolf pack. If you've got a group of wolves like this, you will only actually have one pair of wolves that will breed. So there's, even if you had, if there were, say these ones had young this year, and there were two young in the pack, and they were a year old next year, they wouldn't come in and cycle. They only come into season once a year, and they only come into season in February. But if there is a dominant breeding female in the pack, the behaviour of the wolves actually suppresses the cycle in the other females. It's logical, really. They've evolved this sort of behavioural chemistry, because otherwise, if you had all the females and all the males breeding, you would have hundreds of cubs, and they'd eat themselves out of all their food in the area. Also, the big male, I mean, you will get males who can be up to 4 years old who haven't gone through puberty. One of the key things in looking at a group of wolves, if you've got a challenging wolf, it urinates by standing up and cocking its leg. So that's a very big sort of visual thing to the rest of the wolves. This is a challenger. And most times you'll only have the dominant male cocking his leg to urinate. All the other males will squat to urinate, rather like puppies do. And that's the same with the females. The females will squat to urinate, but the dominant female will stand to urinate, and she'll come up and find a bush or a rock or a tuft of grass. She will stand and cock her leg. It's a, I'm up there with the boys.
Gosh.
I'm the boss. And you do see that in certain domestic dogs. I mean, you'll get some female dogs which will actually be very, very top doggish, and will actually not crouch to urinate. Those are visual things which we still see. Other things in the group, I mean, if you've got a situation here, everyone's fed and they will have a play. Often before maybe that the howl, the dominant animals will be standing around, and the lower ranking animals, and particularly the lowest ranking animals, will come up and lick around the face of the dominant animals, as if to say, you know, we're very submissive, you're the top. But also it's puppy behaviour, because the puppies can get the adults to regurgitate, and they actually stimulate regurgitation by licking around the bottom of the chin. And we see this with domestic dogs, and you meet your dog after you've been out, the dog comes rushing up and is licking you on the chin. You've been off hunting, you know. I've been guarding the home. How about some food? We don't regurgitate for them, though.
No.
But
no.
That's what they're really asking. It's, have you got anything for me? I've been on guard. And wolves, when they've got cubs underground, it isn't necessarily the dominant male and dominant female that stay looking after the cubs. It can be a low-ranking male or female who's left on guard. And that animal will defend those cubs against predators.
Is there any other behaviour? I mean, you touched on some really interesting things there that sort of that relate to pet dogs.
I suppose the absolute surrender is one thing. I mean, in wolf etiquette, if you were being bullied, the way to get away from being bullied is to totally surrender.
Mm-hmm.
So lie on your back and show your belly and show your neck and your belly. Mm-hmm. And that's total surrender. I mean, dogs will do that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that means that a wolf attacking, if you see a dominant wolf bowl over another wolf and it's submissive, it can't do anything. It's, well, you've surrendered. I mean, I'm boss, but you will get very little. I mean, you won't. Now, if a wolf is always challenging another wolf and turns and faces head on, then from that point of view, it will perhaps get attacked again. Well, if it had surrendered, it would be saying, I've surrendered.
Mm.
So there's you see that aggression is and surrender is to a degree in the wolf pack etiquette. And I mean, a dog in your house is really part of your pack and accepts that. And you will get some dogs which wouldn't perhaps, you know, roll on their backs for someone who came into the house. They wouldn't be that friendly with people. They would be perhaps basically pointing at their head at them and being affected. Their body language is alert and on guard rather than submissive. So those sort of body language things. I mean, the tail, wagging tail, is, you can see this in wolves and dogs. I mean, the low wag is very much a friendly contact. Tail up, stiff tail up is I'm very sort of stiff walking is dominant and aggressive, and you'll see that in males and females. The other thing that probably is slightly different from a dog and a wolf is wolves tend to always think that there's maybe we're not going to get fed tomorrow, or we're not going to eat tomorrow. So wolves will actually eat, and the term wolfing your food down. I mean, they will really stuff themselves if there's a lot of food there, and will go around with their bellies absolutely full. So it's very good on occasions for us to give a wolf a complete, you know, so that they are really stuffed and they just are sitting there with absolutely full bellies.
The thing, one of the things that wolves are known for is that howl. How far can that carry?
We know here that we've actually have an experience of the wolves howling here and being heard at a distance of about 7 miles. As the crow flies, that's about the distance of the Hilton at Coyland Bridge on the road going up to Glenmore. We had the husky races going on a few years back, and the huskies, a lot of the teams were actually staying at the Coyland Bridge Hotel, and I was just leaving my house here to go to do a talk for the husky group, and I had a telephone call from the group saying, have the wolves just started howling? And I said, yes, they've just been howling. And they said, because it was amazing. We were out feeding our huskies, and they were out in the snow, tethered up. And they became very alert and listened, and then started howling. Mm. Now, it was a clear night, frost, no wind, and that was the, our wolves were howling, and the huskies, we think, could hear them there, 7 miles away. Mm. And they responded, although I couldn't hear the huskies howling here, maybe the wolves heard them.
Yeah. Wow.
Just in terms of the distance that humans can hear, here in the winter, particularly when it's not windy and it's cold, people on the other side of the strath here, so that's around 2 miles away, on as the wolf howls, I mean at an inch on the other side of the Inch Marshes, which is below us, they hear the wolves howling at night, and the actual sound will carry quite a distance. The volume of sound is enormous. I mean, it just goes off the scale if you were trying to record it on a conventional record player or a conventional tape. The sound is actually comes from a chorus of wolves howling. So you get one wolf howl, it takes breath and starts to howl. So it's and then maybe about 10-15 beats later, another wolf's howling. And then maybe 5 beats later, there's another wolf. And so they build up this sound. Mm. The volume of sound after about a minute is so big that you actually start feeling it in your solar plexus. Mm. You start picking it up in your body. Your body starts feeling the sound. If you hear these sort of big sounds, I suppose you get them. People, if they go to these sort of pop concerts and things, they're feeling body sound, but they are also getting blasted by ear sound. Yeah. So you don't probably realise it at the time you're feeling that sound. But you can actually get to the point where, in our landscape here, where the wolves are howling and you're looking at them, and they could be maybe only 50 metres away from you, and there's a point where the wolf sound actually echoes in the wood in front of the wolf territory. And it appears that the wolves actually are making no noise, mm-hmm. but the noise is coming from the wood. Mm-hmm. And then as you go on, that sound is reinforced again by the next woodland actually reverberating and echoing with the wolf sound. Again, the wolves appear to be just howling silently. You can see them howling, but you can't hear them howling. The howl is actually bouncing around in the woods. And then eventually we'll actually bounce in off Willie's Rocks at the back of the park here. And then you can have these almost 5 echoes of wolves mm-hmm. going around you. Mm-hmm. And it's an enormous sound and very, very stimulating if you're mm-hmm. lucky enough to hear it.
Oh, yeah, okay. Is that an evolutionary advantage, when you think about sort of intimidating other wolves as well? If you can sound like a...
It can... Well, it's almost... It's control of hunting grounds by calling and saying this is our area. It isn't just canids that do it though. I mean, to a degree, things like painted dogs, the hunting dog in Africa, doesn't tend to use the sound like a wolf does. I mean, the group is using yips and a lot of sort of sound like that. But if you were looking at an animal like a lion, lions roar, and if you hear a lion, it's a very distinctive. It's a whoo, oof, 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 and it's the chuff chuff noise you hear at a distance. So other lions in that area will actually know there's a dominant lion in that area, and you will get younger males going, whoops, let's get out of here. While if there's a challenging animal who's on the rampage looking for a new pride, then he'll reply, and then maybe the lionesses go, perhaps there's something interesting around here. While wolves, I think, would be, if you had a single wolf calling, and it was, and then you might get another wolf replying, that might be a way that they could actually get together to form a new pack. While a single wolf hearing a group calling would, and they would know that it isn't theirs, would be very, very wary of coming close, because it could mean, well, basically death in somebody else's territory.
Yeah,
they're very, very territorial. In a wolf pack, there's, it's rather, although you've got the two at the top, you've also got a changing hierarchy within the system all the time. And there's a lot of friction going on between the members of the group. And you'll actually find an animal, if it's very, if it's being bullied a lot and pushed out of the group, it's almost like this is our group and you're not in with us. That one might not be allowed to howl with the group. So it's almost a status thing that we don't accept you as part of the group and we don't want you in our group. But that animal can come back in the group again. It's just a little thing that you sometimes see one wolf not howling. But it's usually, I mean, these usually howl at night, depending on the group leadership. This is young male, young female leading the group. We had a male here who's died many years ago, but he was very organised and he used to have a sort of dawn howl. So he would operate on daylight, so when it was dawn he would have a howl and that would sort of bring the group together and have a howl. What actually happens is the male will whine, or the dominant female will whine as well, and that will gather the group together. And it's a very, very evocative sound. I mean, it can make your hairs on the back of your neck stand up. Frightening to some people, but thrilling to others.
Fascinating.
It was a fascinating interview, and Jeremy is very knowledgeable. And he took the time to tell us a lot of really interesting information. What you've just heard was an edited version, but I do recommend that you listen to it in full on the website. You'll also find on the Dogcast site a link to the Parks website. And it was a marvellous day out, and I really highly recommend it if you ever find yourself in the Highlands of Scotland. You're listening to Dogcast Radio on www.dogcastradio.com.
Hello from the Dogcast Radio News Desk. I'm Nick.
And I'm Kate. This time we bring you news with a Scottish flavour, with the dangers facing dogs out on walks. But first, let's hear how a dog is helping save humans from danger.
Yes, Scotland has its first official fire dog. The Central Scotland Fire and Rescue Service will be using a 3-year-old border collie called Jay to help combat arson and educate the public. Jay, who has his own set of protective footwear to keep him safe during his work, can detect substances such as petrol, and his natural talent allows him to search large areas for fire accelerants much faster than humans would. Jay's other duties involve visiting schools to promote the dangers of starting fires. The key group to talk to is the 11 to 17-year-old range, and Jay is helping to warn and educate them. Word of Jay's work has spread to other fire services in Scotland, and others may well be following hot on Jay's heels.
Meanwhile, up near Britain's northernmost point, John O'Groats, there was a drama involving another of the emergency services. In April, the Wick and Dunbeath Coast Guard had to assist in the rescue of a Jack Russell Terrier called Pip. Pip and his owner were out walking on the cliff when poor Pip ventured too close to the edge and fell into the cold, dangerous seas below. Pip had to stay afloat for 40 minutes until help arrived. But the plucky little terrier was none the worse for his adventure once he was dried and warmed.
And it's not just cliffs that provide danger for dogs in Scotland. For the second time this year, an eagle owl has been on the loose. Apparently, these large birds, who in the wild prey on other birds, small mammals, and even foxes and young deer, are strong enough to lift cats and dogs. Fergus, the pet owl who was on the loose during April, has been known to lift the Staffordshire Bull Terrier who shares his house, and he weighs around 50 pounds. Apparently, Fergus is a nice-natured owl who has been raised around children, and with abundance of wild living prey in the area, dog owners were being advised not to panic.
I wonder whether anyone has advised the dogs themselves not to panic. And finally, we have had many tales on Dogcast demonstrating the devotion that can develop between dogs and people. And we have found another very intriguing one. And the main characters of this true story are laid to rest in Edinburgh.
The great Lafayette was an illusionist in the early 20th century. He was extremely successful, being the highest paid performer of his time, and his incredible shows were very popular. Lafayette's best friend was a dog, a terrier called Beauty. Beauty had been a present to Lafayette from Harry Houdini, another marvellous illusionist. Beauty led a very indulgent existence, indeed having diamond collars, her own suite of rooms, custom-made furniture, and being fed the best food. There was even a notice in the house which shows the high regard in which her master held her. "You may drink my wine, you may eat my food, you may command my servants, but you must respect my dog."
In late April 1911, Lafayette and Beauty travelled to Edinburgh, where Lafayette was due to perform his spectacular show. Unfortunately, Beauty died and Lafayette was inconsolable. He arranged for her to be buried in the Piershill Cemetery in Edinburgh, and he planned to be buried there too. He was lost without his canine companion and announced that he feared his own death was imminent. Beauty's funeral was scheduled for the 10th of May, but on May the 9th, during Lafayette's show, the theatre caught fire and Lafayette was among several people who died in the blaze. There is speculation he died trying to save some of the many animals in the show.
Lafayette's funeral was a splendid affair and his ashes were placed into Beauty's casket, carefully laid between her front paws. It was fitting for Lafayette that the sole occupant of the first car in the funeral procession was his other dog, a Dalmatian, and his old friend Houdini sent a dog-shaped wreath. Lafayette had a sign above his front door which read, "The more I see of people, the more I love my dog," and it is definitely true of this master illusionist that his deep love for his dog was no illusion.
And now it's our turn to do a disappearing trick, because we've come to the end of the Dogcast Radio news for this episode. So, until next time, goodbye.
We had a marvellous time finding out about sled dogs and wolves up in Scotland. And while we're away, you kept the emails coming in. I'd like to share a couple of them with you. This is an email from Jennifer Lanza. It says, "Hello, I'm a listener in Arlington, America, and I love your podcast. I listen to it during my commute and then also leave it on for my dog when I leave, so we listen to it together even when we're apart. I know that sounds strange. My dog, Freya, is a Chinese crested, a breed that I feel is gaining in popularity and one that I would love for you to add to your database or even feature on your show. They are a very unique breed, and whenever I take her for a walk, I'm always stopped by at least two or three people asking me what kind of dog she is, although most of them mistake her for a Maltese with a bad haircut. I also recommended your recent show on Yorkshire Terriers to a friend of mine who was looking to buy one, and she said it helped her finalise her decision to visit a local breeder, and now she was looking forward to bringing home her new little boy in May. Thank you so much, and we'll keep listening." Well, Jennifer, I'm glad you enjoy the show, and I'm glad Freya does as well. And good luck to your friend with her new puppy. I'm glad we've been of help. Another email we've received is from Pedro Campello Cavalcanti. It says, "Hi, Dogcast Radio. My name is Pedro Cavalcanti, and I have one beautiful Labrador here in Brazil. I must tell you that your training tips have saved my life twice. Thank you so much. Everything on your show is wonderful. I can't miss any episode. Julie's voice is so pleasant. Sorry, my poor writing English." Well, Pedro, firstly, glad we've been of help. Secondly, I don't think there's anything wrong with your English. And thirdly, if you're going to say nice things about me, I'm not going to get picky about the grammar. Next time we'll be bringing you a profile of the Bichon Frise and a record-breaking dog. Till then, look after yourselves and your dogs.
Thanks for listening to Dogcast Radio, available from www.dogcastradio.com. That's dogcastradio.com. If you'd like to get in touch with us, and wherever you are in the world, we'd love to hear from you. You can do so in a variety of ways. By phone from the UK, you can contact us on 0121-288-0922. From the US, you can contact us on our American number, which is 315-849-2022. From any other country, you'll need your international exit code and then 44121-288-0922. You can contact us on Skype with the ident Dogcast Radio. That's all one word, Dogcast Radio. By email, you can contact me on julie@dogcastradio.com. When contacting us by email, if you have the facilities, please record your questions or comments and send them to us as an audio file. That way we can include them directly in our programme. We can accept most formats, for example, WAV, MP3. All these methods of contacting us can be found on our website, which is www.dogcastradio.com. And as ever, the final word goes to Jenny.
A dog went to the telegram office, took out a blank form and wrote, "Woof, woof, 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 woof." Clark examined the paper and politely told the dog, "There's only 9 words here. You can send another woof for the same price." "But," the dog replied, "that would make no sense at all."